The work that I'm going to talk about today is a concept, well, I have no financial conflicts of interest to disclose. The work I'm going to talk about today is part of work of the Rudd Center at Yale. And the reason I have our website circled down there is it's rich with information on food and food policy issues. So we have a free email newsletter that goes out every month, a list of podcasts, and a variety of other things that are quite nice. But I also show this to say that it's the contribution of a number of colleagues of mine at the Rudd Center who've been very influential in this issue of sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, and I'd like to thank them. So one of the questions that gets raised in this context of taxing foods is, why are you picking on sugar-sweetened beverages? And this is one thing the industry says, and they're quick to point out that they are only a fraction of the total calories that people consume. So here are some of the reasons why I believe that sugar-sweetened beverages are a place to at least begin thinking about tax policy. Number one is that they're the single greatest source of added sugar in the American diet. Second is that they're completely empty calories, except when there are gratuitous things added like vitamins. There's poor calorie compensation, and this is one of the most interesting things that seem to make sugared beverages different as a special class of food. There's good research showing that the body doesn't recognize calories as well when they're delivered in liquids, and so you just don't feel as full as quickly when you're consuming this. And so there are these very troublesome trends that the percentage of a person's daily diet that's constituted by things that get delivered in liquids has gone way up over the past time. So just to give you an example of how this might play out, let's say we separated the room in half, and everybody on this half of the room got whatever your traditional lunch is, but you consumed 200 calories in excess of that, but you consumed it in solid food. So it could be pizza, it could be ice cream, it could be donuts. You guys eat whatever your traditional lunch is. You get 200 extra calories, but they come in a sugared beverage. And then we follow you to see whether you compensate for the 200 calorie excess in subsequent meals to make up for it. This side of the room would do better than this side of the room. And so the fact that people are consistently consuming so many of their calories in sugared beverages is a great concern. There's also this new issue on the horizon about whether sugar affects the brain as an addictive substance. There's very good research in both using animal models and human brain imaging studies suggesting that sugar does act in this way on the brain, and that it's one of the reasons the companies are going to be unlikely to give up the opportunity to market sugar to people. Second is that there's gratuitous addition of a substance known to be addictive, that is caffeine, sometimes in very large amounts. Next, there's targeting of vulnerable populations, children and people in certain ethnic groups in particular. And second, my reading of the science on this is that it's rock solid, that the links between sugar beverage consumption and risk for obesity and diabetes has been proven as conclusively as one can imagine, and more so than for any other category of food. So for all these reasons, I think sugared sweetened beverages are a great place to start, and we're not the only ones to believe that, and I'll show you that in a minute. The beverage landscape has changed. When I was a child, it was a few flagship beverages of the big companies, and that was about it. But now they've been joined by so many other mother beverages that it's a wide array of things. And this comes into the way the industry portrays what they're marketing, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The world's most valuable brand is Coca-Cola, worth billions and billions of dollars just for what it means as a brand. There are lots of interesting examples of sugar-sweetened beverages, not only the traditional ones we think of, but things like vitamin water would be an example. Vitamin water has a number of versions, and it's being marketed with the most important celebrities in the country. Here you see LeBron James and Kobe Bryant pushing vitamin water. There are a lot of versions of vitamin water, and you see some of them here. Revive, Power, Energy, Focus, Defense, and then I'm not sure what Power is, the triple X version of this is meant to give you, but there are all these different versions here. And so this is called vitamin water, and they have Power versions, Energy versions, Focus versions. They've been sued by a nutrition advocacy group for false and misleading health claims, and in an attempt to have the case dismissed, a Coca-Cola attorney said this: Coca-Cola owns vitamin water. No consumer could reasonably be misled into thinking vitamin water was a healthy beverage. So true, this is funny, but holy cow, how can you have a company saying this after the way they've marketed this product? And does that tell us anything about the ethics and morality of the companies that are pushing these beverages? Here's a graph that shows how the trends have changed for milk and sugar-sweetened beverage consumption from the late 1970s until more recently. In the mid-1990s, the lines crossed. So this is a grave concern for the reasons I mentioned before. The average intake of sugar-sweetened beverages for a typical American is now 50 gallons a year, 175 calories a day for the average child. We figure, by the way, that a penny per ounce tax on sugar-sweetened beverages would reduce average consumption to 38.5 gallons per year, hardly a hardship. The increase in costs have not been uniform across different food categories, and there are economists, including Frank, who know more about this than I do, but the price of soft drinks from this period of time, 85 to 2000, went up by 20%. Sugars and sweets went up by this much, but fruits and vegetables went up by this much. So the increase in price for the soft drinks was less than the cost of inflation. And then during that period of time, it became relatively more difficult to buy fruits and vegetables, relatively easier to buy sugar-sweetened beverages. So in 2009, Tom Frieden, who at the time was the health commissioner of New York City, is now the director of the Centers for Disease Control, and I wrote a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine calling for a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. Excuse me, this idea had been out there for close to two decades before we published this paper, but it hadn't really had traction, and several things had come together to all of a sudden give it traction. One was the national concern about the rising rates of obesity, and the other was the terrible economy that led state and local legislators, and even federal ones, to be looking for new sources of revenue, and a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages would be one. We followed that with a second paper in the New England Journal of Medicine with a variety of other experts on the topic, including Dr. Chalupka, calling for making the public health and economic case for taxing sugar-sweetened beverages. These generated a good bit of attention in the press, and all of a sudden legislators were keen to think about the topic, at least some legislators, and so that and a variety of other things have happened to put it on the national map. Specifically, what we proposed was a penny per ounce excise tax on any beverage with added sugar, and that some or all of the revenues would be used for obesity prevention programs. So if the tax itself, if it's large enough, and a penny per ounce would be, is a public health home run in my mind because of the reduction in consumption of the beverages, but it becomes even more so if some of the revenues could be used for obesity prevention programs. So the estimates are that if a tax of a penny per ounce was done nationally, that it would decrease consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages by up to 23%. 20% is sort of the number I hear most often from the economic models. That's enough to have a public health benefit. The Congressional Budget Office estimated this to be $50 billion health care savings over 10 years, and a tax of that size would generate $150 billion in revenue over 10 years. So these just sound like big numbers, but they're big numbers. $150 billion is an awful lot to do something with if you were able to generate this with a national tax. My colleague at Yale, Tanya Andreeva, published a fine paper in the American Journal of Public Health looking at elasticities of different foods. And what you see at the top are foods that are less elastic, that is, they respond less to changes in price than the foods at the bottom of the list. And so what you see from this is that restaurant foods and soft drinks are among the foods that would be most sensitive to changes in price. So that is another argument for looking at sugar-sweetened beverages as a possibility for a tax. There's a long list of organizations that have called for a reduction in sugar-sweetened beverages and or a tax, and you just see a list of some of them here. As far as I can tell, the only institutions that don't call for a reduction in sugar-sweetened beverages are the ones who sell them. The Centers for Disease Control has made it one of their primary obesity reduction strategies. And at the Red Center, we have a variety of resources that I hope you might find helpful if you're interested in pursuing this issue of sugar-sweetened beverage taxes. First, we have a legislative database that my colleague Roberta Friedman has put together. Again, you can get to all of these by just going to yaleredcenter.org. This allows you to search state by state, policy by policy, to find out what's happening around the country, and it gets updated quite frequently, so it's current. We created this map of legislation that's going on around in the country. 17 states and several cities have become very keen to think about sugar-sweetened beverage taxes. So this went from 0 to 17 in a relatively short period of time, which shows the interesting nature of the idea. And some unlikely places you know, Mississippi, Kansas, and other places where some Republican legislators have introduced the idea of a tax, or what show me that the idea may have traction as we go forward. We also have a tax revenue calculator, which turns out to have been helpful for legislators around the country. And this is available on our website, so you can put in any state and most major cities in the U.S., and it will calculate how much revenue can be generated by a tax of different levels. You plug that in to the calculator as well. And so legislators can look at this and say, well, in my state or city, here's how much we could raise. So here's an example. I just put this in for Colorado, given that that's where we are. And so a penny per ounce tax on sugar-sweetened beverages in Colorado would raise $232 million a year just in Colorado. So that tells you how much intake there is of these things, but it also shows what the revenue generating potential is, and sometimes this will catch the eye of the legislators. We believe that framing the issue is very important. I think nobody understands that more keenly than Andrew Heisel, who's been out there on the ground working on this as an advocate. Whether the revenues, whether you discuss a tax in the context of the revenues being used for something good becomes an important part of the framing. We found that in some political jurisdictions, this is helpful and garners public support for it. In other cases, the legislators just want to use the money for deficit reduction and don't care to use it for public health reasons, and it brings down their enthusiasm for it. So that's sort of a case-by-case basis. The companies are quick to point out that the tax would be regressive, but we point out that the obesity and diabetes are regressive, and there are other ways to address that issue. The companies say that this is a restriction in choice, that it's the food police and the food nannies are telling people what to eat. But in fact, there's sort of an illusion of choice in the American food system. You might find 50,000 products in a typical American grocery store, but that's a very small number of ingredients just being manipulated, colored, seasoned in different ways to create what is relatively small choice. Self-regulation from the industry has completely and utterly failed. The consumption of these sugar-sweetened beverages, we don't believe, is going down when you look across all beverages, not just the flagship ones. While the industry has said that they care about the public health, it doesn't appear to be reflected in their sales. And that we believe that the industry's aggressive lobbying is proof that the tax would work, and I'll show you that in a minute. We also believe that it's important to set expectations in places where taxes are being considered. One is, I believe it's really a historic breakthrough that something as radical as a tax on beverages is even being considered, and that itself constitutes somewhat of a victory. And it feels to me like this is equivalent to the early days of the tobacco taxes. When they got introduced, just the fact that they were considered was a victory. Just like tobacco, as I said, the ideas of a tax is becoming somewhat more normative. The industry lobbying against it, which is extensive, just brings visibility to the topic, and I actually think is likely to be helpful in the long run. The early losses are to be expected. As Andrew will probably mention, the city of Philadelphia came within one vote of passing a 2 penny per ounce tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. So think about what that means for a moment. A 2-liter bottle, the tax on it would be $1.20-something. And that came within one vote of passing. And so these early losses are to be expected, and they'll kick in, I believe, like the tobacco taxes did. And there's tremendous strength in numbers if jurisdictions act together in proceeding with these. How worried is the industry? Here are data from the Los Angeles Times. They collected information on lobbying from the industry from 2003 to 2009. And 2009, again, was the year where taxes started to get introduced, and our papers came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, and you'll see what happened. This is a combination of Coke and Pepsi and their trade association, the American Beverage Association. So what does this tell me? A, that this is a complete politically feasible possibility, or else why would the industry have to lobby so hard against it? And second, that it would have exactly the intended effect on consumption, or else why would the industry have to lobby against it? So I'll end there by saying that I think there's a very strong rationale for reducing sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. Major agencies and institutions around the world have all agreed on that. If you can find another way to help address the obesity problem that could have a quick impact like this and raise money rather than cost it, I'd be happy to hear it. And it seems to me that it's just a matter of time until the first taxes get passed, and then I think they will become the norm. So I appreciate all you being here, and be happy to answer questions at the end.